This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1957, a market researcher named James Vickery coined the phrase subliminal messaging. After allegedly flashing short messages like eat popcorn during a crowded film screening, he claimed to observe dramatic boosts in snack sales. Years later, Vickery admitted to having fabricated the study, but the concept of subliminal advertising stuck. Since then, the psychology behind advertising has grown more sophisticated, the neurological effects more studied, and its methodology more cunning. Dr. David Lewis is author of The Brain Cell, When Science Meets Shopping. The book explores, among other topics, how retailers are influencing our decision-making, sometimes without our knowledge. Dr. David Lewis, a pleasure to have you on the program.
Hello. Hi, Virginia.
So, Dr. Lewis, you write about and study what is going on inside of the brain when we are shopping, when we're searching for something. Tell us what happens when we find a bargain.
Well, we all like to find a bargain. In fact, we've done research in America, in New York and in Boston, where we've wired people up when they're in places where you can buy things, let's say fashion items, at a very considerable discount. And we've actually seen surges of excitement in the brain and also in the body, increased heart rate, for example, increases in skin conductance, which is a measure of how excited people are when they spot a bargain, where they, for example, spot a handbag which they might have expected to pay, I don't know, $500 or $600 for, when it's actually been reduced by half or a third. So this does give us a buzz of excitement. And other studies using a technique called fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, has actually shown changes in the way in which the brain is working when we're presented with something. We all of us like to feel we're smart. We all of us like to feel we're given a bargain, finding a bargain. Unfortunately, very often it's not really a bargain. It's merely designed to make us think we've got a bargain.
You clue us into this concept of the atmospherics, this crafted atmosphere. What is it, and how do retailers use atmospherics to influence our purchases?
Atmospherics are a very important concept now in retailing. In fact, most stores will try and create a very special atmosphere. They'll do this in a number of ways. They'll do this by the design of the store, obviously the design of the displays. They'll do it by the way it's lit, the colours which they use. They'll also do it by different aromas. By injecting a particular aroma into a store, you can significantly increase the sales of particular items. So if any of your listeners are in major stores now, they may just kind of pause and sniff. If, for example, they're in the travel department, they may well find that there's a slight odor of coconut oil. And that's been shown to actually increase people's desire to purchase holidays in the sun. Particularly works in Northern Europe, where we don't get quite as much sun as you do in lots of parts of the States. So by injecting coconut oil into the atmosphere, people are subconsciously reminded of putting, you know, sun cream on other people's bodies or their own bodies when they're lying in the sun. So that's one technique. A very interesting study conducted in Belgium. They infuse the aroma of chocolate into bookshops. These levels of chocolate aroma were so slight that people couldn't actually usually detect them consciously, but nonetheless they affected their behavior in the bookshop. They made people stay longer in the bookshop where there was a chocolate aroma, and interestingly they also tended to buy more copies of a book. I mean, unfortunately for authors like myself, these were not the kind of books I write, but they were actually romantic fiction. And so if you're a romantic fiction novelist, then you perhaps should encourage your publishers to inject chocolate into the bookshops when you have your books on display.
And it's not just in shops. You write about in South Korea, Dunkin' Donuts pumping the smell of coffee into buses whenever their ads played over the radio.
Yes.
Is smell the next frontier here in terms of keying into people's impulse to buy?
Oh, yes. Scent is aroma is terrifically important, hugely important. I was speaking with the with one of the executives of a major company in the States called Scentair, and they supply millions of aromas around the world, and they will craft the aroma. They will actually create aroma, like artists will create a painting or a sculptor. They'll create an aroma which kind of gives the brand image. So for Hugo Boss, for example, they created a particular aroma which which, you know, was designed to add to the value to the brand. So aromas are very, very important, and so too is music. In one study, for example, they found that in a wine shop, when they played classical music, people bought more expensive wine. They didn't buy more wine, but they tended to go for the higher priced bottles of wine, rather than if they were playing sort of pop music, then they tended to go for Plonk.
Let's go further into this kind of immersive crafted environment. Mm-hmm. Disney Enterprise is known for creating one of the most immersive shopping experiences in the world. Clue us into how visitors to the park are being manipulated.
Yeah, absolutely. The Disney corporations are absolutely the masters of creating atmospherics. They create an atmosphere which is very conducive to people not only wanting to go to their various parks, but also wanting to stay there for a long time. So when you arrive, for example, at the Disney World in Florida, for example, one of the things is false perspective. So the Cinderella's castle in Disney World has got actually false perspective, which makes it look even bigger than it actually is. So the length of the street as you're walking up towards the castle looks longer, further away when you arrive and you're fresh, but it looks shorter when you're tired and you're coming back home to the car park.
Dr. David Lewis is with us. He's co-founder and director of research at Mind Lab International, and he's written a new book called The Brain Cell, When Science Meets Shopping. We're looking at how various techniques of retailers and advertisers and marketers work on human beings. Besides the atmosphere of places, there's been a lot of emphasis on good customer service in recent years as a way to, you know, keep loyalty. Are those interactions that we get in customer service with big companies like Disney or even Apple stores, are they scripted? Are they natural? Or is this all calculated?
It very much depends on the corporation. Apple, for example, spend a huge amount of time training their sales staff, the people they call geniuses. They have a genius training manual. And there are certain do's and don'ts in a lot of shops. For example, I understand that at Apple, a salesperson will never refer to an Apple computer or an Apple tablet having a problem, because problem is a negative, it's a pejorative word, so they'll refer to it in some other ways. Another technique which is widely used, not just by Apple, but it's a very traditional technique, is the feel, felt, found technique. So, for example, I want to buy, let's say, a tablet. And I say to the salesperson, well, I'm not sure. I've always used a laptop with a keyboard, and I really like keyboards, and this one hasn't got a keyboard, and I'm not sure I'll get on with it. And the salesman will say, or the salesperson will say, I know exactly how you feel. I felt precisely the same way when I first pick up a tablet, but I have found that in a very short space of time, you get used to not having a keyboard or something like that. So feel, felt, found is a way of kind of engendering empathy, understanding the customer's problems, and then providing a solution. Because essentially, that's what selling is. Selling is providing a solution to the customer's problem. Now, it may be a problem they didn't actually know they had before they came into the store. And what new marketing techniques are trying to do is actually get inside the head of the consumer to understand what kind of problems they're likely to present or be interested in accepting they've got.
Dr. Lewis, you're describing what some advertisers have called the hurt heal kind of proposition, right? You know, you identify a need that needs to be healed, a hurt that needs to be healed. Mm-hmm. And some of this seems quite basic to me. You know, you say you've got a problem, we can solve it. You smell coffee, you buy coffee. Yep. So does discovering which neurons fire or what happens inside the amygdala when we see a combination of colors or a certain font wholly change the game of marketing, or just measure what gets triggered by these tried and true tricks?
First of all, I think it enables advertisers to tweak, let's say, a television commercial, so it has the maximum impact on the demographics it's aimed at. And we do a lot of work in our lab looking at web usability. Of course, so much shopping now is done by clicks rather than going into bricks. Then you have to be able to engage the consumer at a very, very, very rapidly, because people online, perhaps you are yourself, are very impatient. If they don't get the answers very quickly, they're likely to click to another site. So it's all about where do you put your particular messages? Where do you position the brand? What color should the background be? And by making these subtle changes, which you can identify using techniques like neuromarketing, I think you can greatly increase your sales. The second area which people are very interested in is how quite small things can have a big impact. So, for example, looking at fonts, that the way in which the typeface is presented. We offered people a tomato soup to eat. And we gave them a menu which described the soup as delicious tomato soup. And we had two groups. One got a menu printed in what is called courier font, and that's quite a drab font. Mm-hmm. The other was printed in a very flowing calligraphic script. And we asked them to rate the taste of the soup. And those who'd seen the menu in a very elegant font actually rated it as much tastier, and they said they were more likely to buy it. But in fact, it was exactly the same soup. We served it from the same can.
Well, you know, your advice is something that a lot of marketers would take up. They think, okay, we're changing our font. But how about for the people who are trying to resist the urge to impulse buy or overspend, given that so much customer persuasion is happening on a deep subliminal level? Have you got any advice for protecting ourselves from that?
Absolutely. I think I would say that, first of all, and I'm sure, you know, your listeners are savvy enough shoppers to know you should never go shopping for food when you're hungry.
Right.
Because you will overbuy. But that aside, I think you should be aware of three things. First of all, however nice they are, and they're trained to be nice, and they're probably very nice people themselves, sales agents are not your friends. You know, you are there to be sold to. And so their friendliness and their empathy and their understanding, although it may be perfectly genuine, is not an example of genuine friendship. So be aware that the purpose of a sales interaction is for them to sell you something. The second thing I would say is give your brain time to catch up with your emotional responses. Step back. The worst phrase any salesperson can hear is, "I'll think about it," because they know if the customer thinks about it, they probably may not, if it's an impulse buy, want to buy it. So, you know, as you say, step back from the situation. And I think the other thing I would say is be quite cautious about, I mean, people talk about neuromarketing in kind of, you know, 1984 terms, the brave new world and all this kind of thing. In fact, I think a much greater danger to our privacy lies in the way in which big data is being analyzed. This is a whole range of things, from everything from the information provided by your credit card, your debit card, your loyalty card, the information you give away free on social media. This information is extremely important and extremely valuable to people in advertising, marketing, and retailing. And they analyze it in order to try and develop messages which matter to you personally, rather than sort of broadcasting an advert to a million people. They actually want to speak to you, Virginia, as an individual, because if they can do that, if they really understand your likes and dislikes, then they have a much better chance of selling to you. But you've got to bear in mind, on the web, there is nothing. There is no such thing as a free lunch. If you're not a customer on the web, then you're a commodity. And the commodity which is being traded is your personal information.
Well, how about you? You're selling a book. Any kind of messaging you're doing to drive sales?
Well, I mean, yes, selling books is very important, particularly to publishers and to authors as well. We all like to feel that people are interested in our work. But I mean, absolutely, the position on the shelf is hugely important. And people tend to think that a product on the shelf is just on a particularly good shelf, say a right-hand shelf at eye level or just below eye level, because it is. But in fact, it's there because big companies pay a lot of money to supermarkets in order to have their product there. Mm. Yeah, I mean, if I'm in a bookshop and I see my book right down on the bottom, so people have got to bend down, I must admit I will probably move it up a few shelves. You know, I'll use that knowledge. But we actually, we tested the cover. We actually used neuromarketing to test the cover because, you know, designers of book covers, who I think are immensely clever in most cases, produce a whole range of things. So we put ours to the test, and we used neuromarketing to test which of the cover designs was likely to be most effective. So, you know, time will tell.
Well, we bought it.
Indeed.
Dr. David Lewis, co-founder and director of research at MindLab International. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
His new book is called The Brain Cell: When Science Meets Shopping. While many consumers are swayed by advertising, one movement in the 1970s was staunchly anti-commercial: punk rock. When Word of Mouth continues, the punk scene's role in the surprisingly fascinating history of the safety pin.